and NPR.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, something that once seemed futuristic, receiving health care through a screen, has not only become commonplace, but preferable for certain medical visits, including mental health. We're talking about telehealth, real-time visits through a smartphone, tablet, or computer. And as we finish up our series during Mental Health Awareness Month, we speak to Aster Services for Children and Families about the benefits of telehealth. The Lackawack Sanctuary is the ecological field research station in northeast Pennsylvania on the shore of Lake Wallenpaupack. Today we'll learn about their summer events, including a timber rattlesnake talk on Saturday. And after a near-fatal stroke and separation amidst a global pandemic, Rick Van Noy decided to go for a paddle 200 miles on the Delaware River. We'll speak to him about his book, plus Maggie Fitzpatrick. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Closing arguments in the criminal hush money trial of former President Donald Trump are underway at this hour. A jury will soon decide whether Trump is guilty of falsifying business records to cover up payments made to an adult film star ahead of the 2016 election. Speaking to reporters outside of the courthouse this morning, Trump accused prosecutors of using the case to interfere with his bid for re-election.
This is all election hunting, election interfering. It's going after Joe Biden's political opponent because he can't do it himself.
In closing arguments, defense attorneys are expected to attack the credibility of the prosecution's star witness, Michael Cohen, Trump's former attorney and fixer. Prosecutors will likely recap evidence that seeks to show Trump falsified business records to cover up the hush money payments. A special legislative session begins today in Ohio, where Republican Governor Mike DeWine is calling for lawmakers to ensure that President Biden will appear on the ballot in November. NPR's Anna Isaacs reports the issue has become bogged down in an unrelated partisan fight.
Ohio has a ballot deadline of August 7th, before the Democratic National Convention, where Biden will be formally nominated. Ohio has moved its deadline in the past for candidates of both parties, but this time, as part of that ballot fix, Republican state senators tacked on a ban on foreign donations to ballot campaigns, leading Democrats to balk. Democrats say such donations are already illegal and that Republicans are just trying to undermine future ballot campaigns in the state. Anna Isaacs, NPR News.
Stocks on Wall Street opened mixed this morning amid news of a multi-billion dollar cell phone deal. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 131 points in early trading.
T-Mobile has announced plans to buy U.S. Cellular's wireless operation in a deal valued at about $4.4 billion. The acquisition would give T-Mobile more than 4 million new customers, many in rural areas, and bring further consolidation to the cell phone industry. The news gave a boost to U.S. Cellular stock. Crude oil prices rose on the heels of a holiday weekend when tens of millions of drivers took road trips. Retail gasoline prices inched down, however. AAA says the average price of regular gas is about $3.59 a gallon, down about 7 cents from a month ago. Asian stocks were mixed overnight, down in Shanghai and Tokyo, but nearly flat in Hong Kong and Seoul. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks continue to trade mixed this morning. The Dow was down 140 points. The Nasdaq Composite up 54. This is NPR News in Washington. Large crowds are staging demonstrations outside of the legislature building in Taiwan, protesting changes to a bill that gives the opposition-controlled chamber more power. NPR's Emily Fang reports the measure passed today, outraging thousands of people who've been railing against it for weeks.
Demonstrators gathered outside Taiwan's legislative building as the bill was passed into law. The law was proposed by Taiwan's opposition parties. Members say it evens out the checks and balances, and it introduces more transparency over the island's powerful executive branch. The new law allows legislative members to subpoena anyone and fine them or put them in prison for up to 1 year if they don't cooperate or if they ask too many questions when subpoenaed. Civil society groups and many supporters of Taiwan's ruling party have vociferously criticized the law, saying it gives individual lawmakers too much power and that it was passed without open discussion. Emily Fang, NPR News, Taipei, Taiwan.
Officials in Papua New Guinea say they're concerned about a second landslide. Search and rescue operations continue at the site after a massive landslide struck the South Pacific island on Friday. The United Nations says at least 670 people have been killed. Local officials say it's believed that more than 2,000 people have been buried alive. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Project Lead the Way, where they believe learning by doing helps every student in every grade be STEM successful. Learn more at pltw.org/NPR. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and all month long we were partnering with Aster Services, a nonprofit that offers services related to children's mental health in the Hudson Valley and in the Bronx, to help eradicate stigma, foster education, and prioritize the well-being of individuals and families affected by mental illness. As we close out the month, today we're talking about something that once seemed futuristic, receiving health care through a screen. It's not only become commonplace, but preferable for certain medical visits, including mental health. It's telehealth, real-time visits through a smartphone, tablet, or computer. And both adult and pediatric providers say that during the COVID-19 pandemic, the public health emergency pushed the concept of telehealth and mental health care into the mainstream. In fact, research from the Journal of the American Medical Association showed a rapid growth in telehealth services for mental health care from 39.4% in 2019 to 88.1% in 2022. Radio Catskill's Patricia Robayo spoke to Dr. Todd Carlin, the Chief Program Officer at Aster Services for Children and Families, about the benefits of telehealth.
It's been transformative, especially since the pandemic. We at Aster had just dipped our toes into telehealth prior to COVID. We were doing a little bit of services from our school-based satellites so that we could connect students who were receiving services at those centers with psychiatric and med providers. And then suddenly, March of 2020, within a couple of weeks, we were doing more telehealth sessions by the end of the month than we had done live sessions earlier in the month. And that went not only for our clinic services, but for everything we were doing. School-based services, our day treatment programs, our partial hospitalization program. And then over the past couple of years, it's stabilized where for many of those programs, especially the more intensive programs and the school-based programs, telehealth is now something that augments the other services. It's mostly live and mostly back in person. But for our clinics, telehealth has remained a significant delivery model for us.
Wow. So what do you find the most effective by using telehealth for treating mental health issues?
There's a flexibility. It's a tool that allows you to be creative in the way that you can bring people into treatment and make sure that they can receive services. One of the things that we've gotten back to over the past couple of months is open access so that anyone can walk into a clinic and be able to see someone the same day for a first intake appointment and to begin that therapeutic work together. One of the things telehealth allows you to do is, yes, you may be able to see someone live in the door or someone you may be waiting a little bit of time to see in a waiting room. But if you want to see someone even sooner, you can go into an office and we can connect you with a clinician who's operating out of a different office or even a different region. Or someone can go back home to the privacy of their own home and access care. For a lot of folks, also, there's a lot of things that telehealth offers in flexibility in accessing services. Obviously, when there's issues in public transportation, when folks are having issues with childcare, it can be incredibly difficult to, whether you're traveling by car or subway, get a whole family together to go to an office, to sit in a waiting room, to to have an accession where you can do that from the convenience of your own home. And while there also is been a real progression in the willingness to have conversations about self-care and wellness, and I'm very thankful that one thing the pandemic has served is to bring the conversation about getting treatment and behavioral health services and mental health needs to light, there's still a significant stigma that we know that can be there around seeking services. We know that some folks are not going to feel comfortable sitting in a waiting room, or that may be a barrier to getting care. So being able to seek services remotely is amazing and allows people, again, to maybe take a step they wouldn't have otherwise. One last thing I'll say also on that access to service is the continuity of services you can do via telehealth. So let's say that you've been in services all year and getting live services at a school-based setting. What happens during the summer or summer school? In the past, folks might schedule a session or might come into one of our brick and mortar clinics and come in, but now they can maintain the relationship with their primary clinician and continue to see people throughout the summer. Or even when people have gone away to college, they've been able to continue and that therapeutic work where, because we know the first year in college can be a really difficult one for folks, and being able to have that continuity of services, as well as if there's a crisis, when sometimes people are out of school because there could be busing challenges, there could have been a suspension, there could be other things going on. You can bridge those live services with telehealth to augment what someone's getting out of school.
Yeah, absolutely. Just breaking down some of the barriers that might be there. Like you mentioned transportation, another one, just keeping up with the schedule there. So you mentioned a little bit some of the groups that can benefit from this. But can you tell us in what specific groups of people who use telehealth this has made a big difference for?
I think it's been a tool that's really helped in a lot of ways, especially with family and when we're doing systems work. One of the things that we saw that was really beneficial, especially early in the pandemic when everybody was at home all the time, was we were bringing therapy into the home in a more meaningful way. And that, I'm sure, for some families was a little bit challenging, because now, okay, we're really doing this. We're really having this session. It might be at a dining room table, during homework time, during dinner time. But that's where some of those challenges and behaviors and stressors for families are. And really being able to do that work in a meaningful way and in really what is a family's natural environment accomplishes things that you really sometimes can't do in the same kind of way in a typical therapy session, where you're talking about the challenges at home, and then you've got to work on things in a therapy session and then bring them home. While here we can really bring the treatment to home. In addition, telehealth offers you the ability to invite anyone you want to into a session. So it's a little easier to get a whole family together. So not only is it the person who would be bringing someone into treatment, you can bring in mom and dad, or grandma, or uncle, or whoever else is really important, and we can get the whole family together in one place. So being able to do that family work, which is so important to the work, because parents are the most important when we're talking about working with children and adolescents. There's nothing more important than being able to work with the family. You can't treat a child in isolation. It's got to be the family system. So for parents, whether it's doing a family session together, whether it's doing a collateral session, maybe it's something where a parent can take a therapeutic telehealth session call at lunchtime and be able to catch up on how things are going and recent challenges and be able to coordinate on things with the therapist. Those are things we just couldn't do before, couldn't do the same way with phone calls that we can now do with formal telehealth.
Yeah, absolutely. Just like I've heard people who have done telehealth, mental health services, and you're actually right that there's times of the day that they're available and they could put in a session in with their therapist during the day because of telehealth, instead of driving X number of miles there to have a session there. So as always, there are challenges with any type of service. What challenges do you face using telehealth and mental health treatment?
Nothing is for everyone. I think telehealth is a tool and it's a great one. Sometimes it can simply be lack of comfort with the technology. We talked about getting everybody in the family together. Sometimes a child or adolescent and mom or dad may be comfortable, but sometimes aunt or grandma or Someone else may not be as comfortable with it, but it's not just generational. There are some people who just don't feel from a learning style or connection style that they can get that same connection in telehealth that they do from in person. It's a different relationship and it's a different connection. I think there are some folks who find, especially if they're doing, let's say, a group session, we've seen kids and adolescents who may feel very distracted also even by seeing their own picture on screen. And some platforms are really good at being able to hide that picture so you're not concentrating on seeing yourself on the screen with other people. But we have to be really conscious of that when we're talking about what the telehealth session is going to look like. And the fact that also the needs may change from the time that you start doing therapy along the way. Maybe something happens where maybe this isn't working so well. Maybe the connectiveness isn't right there, or maybe there are some needs that we feel would be better addressed live. And that's something we really want to talk about at the very beginning, that starting a session and starting a series of treatment sessions in telehealth doesn't necessarily mean that it has to continue that way. You can always shift to coming in to see a therapist, a med provider, a psychiatrist, to a live session, because it's a different connection. And there is something for seeing folks in the room that's a little bit different than when you're just doing telehealth alone.
Yeah, absolutely. You just mentioned some of the challenges. What came up to mind, maybe early on in the pandemic when folks were, a lot of children were going to remote learning. But one of the challenges that we had here in Sullivan County was a lot of rural places did not have internet connection. I know I didn't have high speed connection until literally a month before the pandemic hit. I was dealing with satellite internet, which is, if you're satellite internet, it's just horrible. It's just no download speeds. I'm sure that's another challenge that thankfully it has been improved. A lot of places have gotten high speed internet since the pandemic started, but I'm sure that's also a challenge that option's there. The option is not there for some folks.
No, one of the things we are obligated to do as part of telehealth is make sure that the connection is strong enough so that we can say that what we're doing is viable and it would be comparable to doing sessions as if you're in the same room together. If that's not something that you can see either on the clinician's internet side or on the client side, then it's best to try to meet in person. But that what you just mentioned is something, yes, we've heard from the counties. We've actually, as we've been expanding into Sullivan, it's something we were very aware of heading in, that broadband connection is not yet an option for everybody. So that brings it back to some of those travel needs and trying to figure out how to work or to take advantage of different things. One of the models that's actually worked, and I know that some places are beginning to build upon, is to utilize some connections maybe from school settings and from other locations so that they can use that as a hub to then connect to someone at another site. That's an expansion work that I know that is happening right now in the city. And it's another way to utilize what resources you have to make sure that you can then still use that connection where you know someone's going to be at a reliable time each week, use a dedicated hardline, and still make that therapeutic connection.
Now, you mentioned that you're taking these sessions at home. I know in the past, speaking from teachers, it's hard to keep kids engaged because they're home. And you have things popping up on their computer, things popping up the phone. So how do you engage children and young adults during telehealth sessions to keep them comfortable and keep them focused on the session, not be distracted by all these outside things?
I'll tell you, when the kids were doing the remote learning and they had that 7 hours a day. So imagine trying to have someone sitting at their computer for 7 hours a day doing remote learning and then try to do a therapy Zoom session in between or after that. That was incredibly challenging. But I think one of the things therapists have done now is they've built out their therapeutic tools for working online. It still doesn't mean that it's going to work perfectly for all kids in all situations, but it's definitely something now where if you walk into a therapist's office who's working with young kids, but it's not a couch, it's not a blank slate, you're going to see games, you're going to see books, you're going to see therapy tools, you're going to see things because it's an engaged, active process. So what they do with the kids in the session is often particular therapeutic sites that allow for games that deal with turn-taking, frustration tolerance, teaching skills, psychoeducation, bibliotherapy. Those are the tools that we're utilizing during online sessions that are very similar to the kinds of tools you do if you were together in a therapy room. So they're just an online version of some of those same kinds of tools. I will say, though, that you still sometimes are going to need that physical person at home, because like it's not a room with a door. We, you know, there's no seatbelt at the desk. So sometimes it is going to be mom or, you know, mom, dad, caregiver in the room who's also supporting the session, who's also hanging out there to make sure things are staying on target, support with that redirection, which can have some real great advantages too, because it can bring the whole family into the session too.
Yeah. So if someone's listening to this and considering using telehealth for their mental health services, what advice do you have for them? Someone who might be hesitant?
I would say that the best thing to do is to have the conversation. If that's what you're seeking or trying to figure out if this is something that would be for me, and you're meeting with either a therapist that you've already seen live and considering going through telehealth, or even just starting out, talk about it in terms of what would the pros and cons be? What does the clinician feel would be helpful or not helpful about going that route? You really want to make an informed decision like you do with any kind of treatment when you're talking about using telehealth as a tool. And I would also say the most important thing is if it's not working for you, say something. If it doesn't feel like you're getting that same connection or anything out of it, say something. One of the great things about the community behavioral health centers, Aster included, is that we are obligated to have a live option back at our brick and mortar clinics too. So if it's not working or it doesn't feel like it's the great fit, have that conversation. If you're a parent and you don't feel like your child is getting what you'd want them to be getting out of the session, have that conversation to weigh the benefits. And we as therapists actually do the same thing. And sometimes we have to have that conversation with family members and say, yeah, I know there's like really some great things. And we know there's certain things that allow, or there's either the convenience or the travel or other pieces, but we want to do what's best for you. We want to do what's best for, you know, your family. So we're going to make a decision together that's going to be the right tool for treatment.
Dr. Carlin, before we leave, is there anything else I have not touched on you want folks to know about, either telehealth or just what Aster Services provides?
We provide a pretty comprehensive array of clinical services, all the way from prevention, all the way from crisis supports and services in our clinics, in our crisis response programs, including home-based crisis intervention, partial hospitalization program. I think during Mental Health Awareness Month, what we really want is for folks to feel comfortable with that conversation, to reach out, and it doesn't have to be to Aster. It could be for someone at your school, at your doctor's office, if it's a clergy member or something of a faith-based connection. If there's something, though, that you feel is not right, that you want to get more information on, just have that initial conversation. There are so many helping folks in the community who can connect you and put you in the right direction and get you the supports and help you need. We want to make sure that people are taking advantage of that at every turn.
We're talking to the Chief Program Officer at Aster Services for Children and Families, Dr. Carlin, for May being Mental Health Awareness Month. Thank you so much, Dr. Carlin, for talking to us and letting us know the benefits, some of the challenges you face using telehealth for mental health. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Anytime. Thank you so much again for having.
In Liberty, I'm Patricio Robayo for Radio Catskill.
And Aster Services is a community-based nonprofit that provides children's mental health services, child welfare services, and early childhood development services in the Mid-Hudson Valley region and in the Bronx. There's information at asterservices.org. We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll learn more about the Lackawack Sanctuary, the Ecological Field Research Station, Nature Preserve, and Public Environmental Education Facility right here in Northeast Pennsylvania on the shores of Lake Wallenpaupack. This is Radio Chatskill.
The mixtape's all about eclectic music, compiled with love, like an old-school mixtape. I'm Jason Tuga, and every Friday night, it's my aim to bring you something special, a unique mix of music you wouldn't hear anywhere else. You can count on hearing a diverse range of artists, eras, genres, and vibes. The Mixtape, an hour of music assembled by me just for you, Friday night.
Friday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Lackawack Sanctuary in Lake Ariel, Pennsylvania is dedicated to shaping the next generation of scientists and earth stewards through research, education, and preservation. They have a full slate of summer events to help them do just that. And here to tell us more is Craig Lukacs, the president of Lackawack Sanctuary. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for being here. And let's talk a little bit about the sanctuary itself. I just mentioned that briefly, you know, you're an ecological field research station. You're dedicated to making more earth stewards and scientists, the next generation of those. Talk a little bit about your mission and how you guys do that.
Sure. So we were founded as a nonprofit back in 1966. Long history of property being the area about conserving nature. And when we started our nonprofit, it's a threefold mission. The first part of it's research, and obviously we're doing ecological research. We've been doing long-term monitoring and research on the environment, mostly water quality and climate change. We've also, the second part of our mission is education, and how that plays out is by offering K-12 programs, field trips, public walks and hikes, and general public information sessions about different things all related to nature. And then the third part of our mission is preservation. It's not only preserving the land that we have here at Lackawack, which is 550 acres, but also our historic buildings that are located on our property, as well as multiple other sanctuaries and preserves that we have throughout the area.
And I want to talk a little bit about the research side of it, too, because you guys host scientists from all over the country. Can you talk a little bit about some of the research that folks have conducted and that's currently being conducted?
Sure. So some of the schools that are currently working with us right now is Drexel University out of Philadelphia and RPI and RIT, Rochester Institute of Technology. And most of their research has to do something with water-based, really. Interesting note is that our research has been going on here for a long time. We share our research with lakes across the world. We have a special lake here at Lackawack that's pretty much unpolluted because it's been preserved and stuff for a long time. And what we share our research with the lakes across the world. And so we're part of this global network of lake observation units or field stations. And we've really had some of our research been presented to the United Nations and basically saying that our lake has changed over the last couple of years, but we have done nothing to our lake. So it's a very valuable base lake to compare to other lakes that have very heavy usage by boating and people living on the lake and stuff like that. So so that's been our research over the years, and that's what most of the schools come to Lackawack to do, is also to participate in aquatic research.
Mm. And when you mentioned the observation network, this is the ecological observatory network. You're kind of a hub for that. Can you explain a little bit more about what this the EON is and how it's why it's so important?
So it's important, first of all, because we're monitoring our lake, you know, 24 hours a day. There's all these sensors in our lake and measuring things like pH and temperature and you know, oxygen levels and stuff like that. And so we're part of this, it's a short name that we say GLEON, which is the Global Lake Ecological Observation Network. But then at the same time, we also have a very similar thing called PLEON for Lackawack. That's one of our programs where we're monitoring local lakes in the region. So within Pennsylvania, New York, and New Jersey, we're monitoring those lakes. So it all ties together in the sense that, you know, we're noticing things are happening on these lakes that we're not doing anything to it, meaning like temperatures, surface temperatures are changing. They're getting warmer in the summer, but we're not doing anything to the lake or to the lakes. Ice is not staying on it throughout the whole winter as it should have been in the past. So we're noticing these changes, and we can use all this research to compare and say, okay, what's happening in this region? What's happening at statewide? You know, what's happening on a national level? So it's pretty interesting. You know, I've been here for 10 years, and you know, at first it didn't make complete sense, but now that you see it over a 10-year period, it makes absolute sense now. But things are happening. Things are changing in the world around us, and we're not really, you know, here at Lackawack, we're not doing anything to our lake, but clearly things are happening.
Clearly, yeah, there's a lot happening, and you guys are dedicated to, as you mentioned, the preservation, the research, but also education. Talk a little bit about the education component and, you know, building that next generation of scientists and Earth stewards.
Right. So recently we had the opportunity to build a brand new education center. In our history, we took our founders home, and, you know, we had this vision for since 2009 to have this wonderful education center that we can bring students in and to do field trips and to do stuff in the laboratory. And we've always had crude kind of areas that we would have kids and we didn't really have good spaces, like if it rained or something like that. And so we had the opportunity to build a $1.5 million new education center. And we just recently opened it within the last month. We opened it at the beginning of this month. And the whole purpose of that is to bring kids here, K to 12 students, all different levels, all different grades, to learn about nature and what's happening in the environment around us. You know, we feel that kids today, you know, are on the computers a lot. When I was a kid, obviously, I was outside playing all day, right? So overturning rocks. And I think right now is kids don't get that opportunity. So we have to get them here, get their hands dirty, and really engage with nature. And so we have all the different curriculums that we do based on the ages and the grades of the kids, all the way up through high school, where they're doing laboratory work, just like some of our scientists would do. So we were lucky to have this new building, but, you know, as we speak today, we have a huge field trip here. 120 kids are on property, you know, doing some aquatic investigations. So it's a very powerful time for the students. We also go into the classrooms and work with the teachers that way. And then, you know, not to diminish anything, but we also do public programs, meaning that anyone from the public can come to one of our programs. You know, and we have topics like, you know, one of the cool programs we have coming up is about rattlesnakes and rattlesnakes in our area. Not the ones that we think of like, you know, across the world, but, you know, why are they, you know, they're dangerous, but, you know, we want to talk about like, you know, what do you do when you see them? What do they look like? And, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of great programs that we just want to educate everybody about the natural world around us.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's so cool. Like, you have all these kids there today, aquatic investigation. That would certainly get me off my computer to, like, go play and research in the water. But this also, when you mentioned the timber rattlesnake, that is coming up this Saturday at 10. Mm-hmm. You're talking about that in, you know, the history, ecology, but also conservation, like why it's important to conserve this particular rattlesnake.
Right. So I think for us, you know, if we don't teach the younger generations why we should preserve the land, it's not instilled upon them at school anymore. You know, I mean, I think when I grew up, it was a little bit different. Kids don't have that connection to the natural world around them. And we really have to show them that, you know, your actions that you choose, you know, affect the world around us. Water, because that's what we drink. You know, one of our programs that when we talk about water, we always say there's no new water. The water's recycled and reused. You know, when you think about it, there's no one producing new water. It's we're purifying the water and stuff like that. And that's what the natural world around us does. So we really want to have those kids have those connections to the natural world and say, okay, yeah, my actions really make a change, or my actions really impede the environment and do damage to the environment. And so our goal is to say, hey, you need to be the change makers in the future. So
one of the other ways to help promote that too is also on Saturday at 11, right after that rattlesnake seminar, the Lunch and Learn June seminar about lake sediments and climate change. And examples from Northeast Pennsylvania. You've got the associate professor of geology at Wilkes University for that Lunch and Learn too. And then also coming up, I want to make sure we mention the evening paddle on the lake on Wednesday. Mm-hmm. Walk with a doc, walk with a doctor, someone to help with your healthier lifestyle. And then the tour of the Historic Waters Lodge coming up June 8th. There's so much more to talk about. We'll have you back. But I also, before we go, just wanted to mention and congratulate you on the grant that you received recently, support for the Environmental Education Center. Can you talk a little bit about that grant and why it's so important?
You know, for us having, you know, like I said, the Environmental Ed Center and all the grants that supplement the programs go in there, because one, as a nonprofit, you know, we are not receiving, you know, in the sense, you know, funding from the federal government and that kind of stuff. So all of our funds come from the general public, from foundations, from supporters, to allow us to carry on our mission. So that's why these grants are important to us. We've been really blessed and lucky to have the support of our community to say that this is an important mission that we have here at LACWAC, because otherwise we wouldn't be able to do these programs A lot of the programs are free to the public. For our schools, you know, our field trips are practically reduced. We offer a lot of scholarships because this day and age, a lot of schools can't even afford to, you know, bus kids to an outdoor area, you know, so we really want to make sure that they have those opportunities. So if that means us getting grants to supplement that, that's why it's important to us for all these purposes, not only just building a building, but also to provide all the services and all the programs.
Yeah, I think it's really cool, and people may not realize how amazing the work is that you guys are doing there with not only kids, but students, people from all over the world with research and education. You know, people are out on the lake having a great time boating, but you guys are doing some really important research and education there. So I want to make sure we highlight that. Where can folks get more information, and where can they get involved if they want to learn more?
So we can go to our website. It's a very robust website with all of our programs, all of our information about what we're offering, about our mission. It's lacwac.org. And I always like to spell for everyone, it's lacawac.org. So it's pretty simple, but it's one of those words that people sometimes misspell.
Yeah.
And then if you can find us on social media too, Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. Most people do Facebook and Instagram with us, but we're on there as well too. We post our programs there as well. But everything that you need to know about LACWAC is on our website. So
yeah, and what are you planning to do with all those kids today? What's on their agenda?
Sampling at the lake and our pond, and then taking the macroinvertebrates and what they found in the water under microscopes, and looking further into the composition of what's in water. And you know, you don't realize. It's crazy when you look at a microscope, you're like, wow, that's what's in the lake, you know? And so they're floored by that. So they'll be doing that today, and they spend lunch with us. And then it's a nice day out of school. Today's a beautiful day. So they have it really lucky. And we do our programs rain or shine, believe it or not, unless there's like a thunderstorm, but we love doing it. We feel that kids need to go out even if it's raining, because you can't let the environment stop you from enjoying nature.
Yeah. So. Well, I'll let you get back to inspiring that next generation of scientists. Craig Lukacs Craig Lukacs is the president of the Lackawack Sanctuary in Northeast Pennsylvania, right there in Lake Ariel. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right, we'll take a break. And when we come back, Maggie Fitzpatrick, Moving Toward Health. This is Radio Chatskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
Hey there, I'm Cassie of Rare Pair Radio. It's a weekly showcase of primarily female artists, but also a wide range of avant-garde musicians. I will be playing the fruit of post-punk, experimental, and fringe music, only on WJFF Radio Catskill. Rare Pair Radio, Friday at 8 p.m.
Radio Catskill, keeping you connected with the local edition. Weeknights at 6, right after All Things Considered. The local edition, only on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Every Tuesday, we speak to Maggie Fitzpatrick from the Sullivan County Democrat about her column, Moving Toward Health, trying to get us all into a healthier lifestyle. It's out today on newsstands in the paper or online, scdemocratonline.com. Maggie Fitzpatrick, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Did you have a nice weekend?
I really did. And good. I was just talking to Mimi about this, but it actually felt long, which was lovely.
It did. Yes. Yeah. It felt like a long weekend. It was nice. The weather was a little thunderstormy yesterday.
Mostly good. Yeah.
Mostly good. Let's talk about Moving Toward Health today. What did you bring us for our post-long weekend inspiration today?
I brought you a pile of rocks.
That'll be helpful. What will the pile of rocks do to help us?
Yeah, actually, I did write about a pile of rocks. So I was writing about belief in ourselves. And what had happened was over in the fall, like months ago, my husband and I took a day trip to Long Island. I was going to a friend's baby shower and he just like found a beach to explore while I was there. He wanted to drive down with me and, you know, kind of just like hang out. So when he came back to pick me up, he showed me these like rocks he gathered from the beach. And he was like, I just thought these were really cool. I want to bring them home. And they were all pretty small. Like the biggest one is smaller than the palm of my hand and they all get smaller. And he kind of just set them down on the counter and there they, you know, there they were, new counter decorations. And we found ourselves trying to stack them, right? So we have like the biggest one on the bottom and then all the way up to the smallest ones. And for months, it was absolutely impossible. Like we were convinced that it was not possible to stack these rocks. And then one day my mom was over at our house. She was there. We were not there. She was there. And she sends us a photo. She has all the rocks stacked. And we were like, this is crazy. Like, how did you do that? This is impossible. Like, we haven't been able to do this yet. And of course, you know, we're like, she used crazy glue, like making kind of all these excuses as to why she was able to do it and we were not. But the fact of the matter is, like, she was able to stack them and we just hadn't been able to yet. And so it happened repeatedly where she would send us a photo of her being at our house and she had all the rocks stacked. And we're like, why can you do it and I can't do it? Like, this doesn't make any sense. So then maybe like two or so weeks ago, I was home alone. I was sitting at the island where these rocks live on my counter. And I was like watching a video on Instagram or something. And I started stacking the rocks. And you know, when you're doing something, you don't really realize you're doing it because you're paying attention to something else. So I had like four of them stacked before I realized what I was doing. And so then I look and I'm like, oh, this is very good progress, like very good progress. So I intentionally was like, okay, don't put a lot of pressure on yourself. Just like pick up the next one, put it on there, and it stayed. And I was like, oh, wow. So now I'm just left with this very tiny rock, like this very, very tiny rock. And I pick it up and I put it on and it stayed. And I freaked out, obviously, right? And I'm home by myself and I'm like so excited. I'm like, oh my gosh, I did it. I did it. And so now I'm trying to get my phone to take a photo. Obviously, I have to send it to the family group chat to let everyone know that I stacked the rocks and without knocking them over, of course, right? And so I did that. I was so excited. And then the top two fell off. And I was like, oh, let me just like put them back on. So I picked them up, put them back on, and they stayed. And I was like, why is this so easy now? Why is it so easy? I could not do this for months. My mom was able to do it. And now all of a sudden, it's easy. And it got me thinking, is it really about our skill or is it just that we believe we can do it? Like, yeah.
You weren't using the rocks as your exercise.
No.
This, you're saying like when it comes to your health, these factors apply. What you're saying is it how I think or is it my skill?
Exactly. Like, of course, skills matter, right? The ability to do things matters. But can we cultivate the ability to do things without believing that it's possible? Probably not. Yeah. Right. That belief that it's possible for us has to come first. And this is why, you know, last week we were talking about comparison and how comparison can be a trap, right, that we get stuck in. But sometimes we need to look outside of ourselves to believe something is possible for us, right? Like, how can I draw inspiration from someone or something else to believe something is possible for me so that way I can work towards that too?
Yeah. And I have another story next here, which is it's a little longer and it's about overcoming this and what's possible. So we're gonna kind of pause our conversation for now, but you can catch Maggie's column in the Sullivan County Democrat on newsstands or SC Democrat online. This is about Rick Van Noy. After a near fatal stroke and a separation and amidst the global pandemic, he decided to go for a paddle. It's not just a paddle. He paddled 200 miles on the Delaware River, and it's captured in his book called Born by the River. He charts the discovery, his discovery and healing that came from this solo canoe journey. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi has more.
Good morning, Rick, and welcome to Radio Chatskill. And we're here today to talk about your book, Born by the River, Canoeing the Delaware from the Headwaters to Home. So let's start with how this idea was born. After all, it's a 200-mile journey, correct?
That's right. The title is Born, B-O-R-N-E.
Yes.
But I was also, you know, I'm playing a little bit with the idea of being born as in birthed, next to the river. I grew up, I was born in Trenton, New Jersey, and I lived only about 7 or 8 miles up river in a little town called Titusville, which is really just above where Washington crossed the Delaware. The river was always really just very formative in my childhood and growing up. And I canoed some sections of it, but I always kind of wanted to do the whole thing. And it was actually in 2019, I had a stroke. I had somehow injured my neck somehow, like the kind of thing you get from whiplash.
Yeah.
And that led to a small tear in the internal carotid. And then there was a clot repairing the tear. And then, I had a helicopter ride and all that kind of stuff to the hospital.
Oh, dear.
So 2 years later, on the anniversary of that trip, and that was in the middle of the pandemic, I was, I said, well, what are you going to do? Why don't you go back to the river? Why don't you go back to, kind of where you were born and do that river? I think I said in the end, it was almost like, the Delaware has shad that returned to their, where they were born.
Yes.
Like, they're anadromous fish. And I almost felt like one of those fish heading back to its home waters. So, yeah.
Yes. Well, we have a shad festival up here. So we know all about shad.
Yeah, they have one in Lambertville, too. You have one? Where's yours held?
I'm not exactly sure, but it's up around in Sullivan, Delaware County. It would be somewhere between Hancock and Long Eddy.
Yeah, okay, good. Right.
Yeah, I believe that's it. But
which was a really pretty section to paddle.
Well, I will share my experience with that going back 30-odd years ago when I purchased a house with other folks up in Long Eddy. And I remember my neighbor saying to me that going upriver in the Long Eddy, which there is a Long Eddy, was a primeval experience. And also coming down to Lordsville.
Lordsville. Yeah.
But it was, over the years, I shared it with 3 different dogs. And there used to be a rock the locals would call Valerie's Rock. So so I'm familiar with it. Yeah. And I'm also familiar with a bunch of folks you met along the way. So maybe. Can you tell us about that?
Right in that little section. I mean, I started in Hancock, and I think I had lunch at the diner. And then I think that first day, I met some people on the bank in Equinunk, and they were like, hey, what are you doing? In fact, one woman was like, you're my husband. And she said she had opened herself to the universe, and there I was. And then, we laughed about that, and then we just, it was something about maybe the time we were in, kind of coming out of the pandemic.
I think
people were just really welcoming and opening and wanting to connect with each other. And they called me over, and I let my dog Sully out, and she played with their dog. And then, pretty soon they were sharing, I think, their black bean and caprese salad with me, and I was sharing the beer that I had in my cooler. And we spent the afternoon just talking. So that was great. And then I think I camped that night kind of over by Lordsville by and in the morning, there really is an interesting, almost kind of art installation there.
Yes, it is. Boris.
Boris. I guess that was, it was almost kind of a trippy thing. There's like an ice cream. There's a double-decker bus with a the name of an ice cream company on it. And I didn't get to talk to anybody in Lordsville, so I didn't get to talk to Boris.
Oh, too bad. He's a very interesting and very sweet man. He's Ukrainian. He's from Ukraine.
And, oh, is that right? Okay.
Yeah.
So I didn't get to talk to him. But I guess there was a Russian poet who also had lived there. And there
that
was
is true.
Museum.
Yeah.
Konstantin Kaminsky, or I think.
I think that's it. Yeah, yeah.
But that really was a pretty stretch. In fact, you know, and earlier that river, you know, earlier that year, I think I had paddled the Middle Fork of the Salmon, which is a, you know, really gorgeous river. You know, but the people on the bank and I were saying, well, but this is a really gorgeous river too. The analogy I was using was something like, you know, maybe those rivers out west are almost more like, you know, Notre Dame or something like that. But the Delaware there almost reminds me of like a, just a little stone chapel in the hills somewhere. It's a smaller, more kind of intimate setting.
Yes.
Really beautiful.
Yes. Yes. You're bringing back some wonderful memories for me. And I'm sure for a number of folks that will be listening to this as well. So what was the most, let's say, exciting thing that happened, the most frightening thing that happened?
There wasn't really anything too frightening. I mean, I think as I started to get into the more populated areas, the busier areas, it was always, you know, a question of where I would camp. But there usually are, there, you know, the Delaware's, there are islands I could camp on. And
yes.
Then when you get to Port Jervis, most of the bank is, you know, or a good portion of it is public land, you know, because of the proposed Tox Island Dam, the park, you know, the Park Service had, or the federal government had purchased some of that land. It was to be flooded. So there was really good camping there. You know, I think in one section, somebody where I was looking to camp, somebody was practicing some sort of target practice, and that was a little bit unnerving, like, you know, just hearing gunfire.
But for
the most
happen.
Part, it was, you know, it was, I mean, a few of the rapids were exciting. Skinner's Falls.
Oh, yes.
It's pretty exciting. Fowl Rift is further down near Belvedere. And that's, you know, that's pretty hairy to get through. There's a way to get through it on the right side, but there was a tree down on the right side, what paddlers call a strainer, because the way it can, you know, trap you almost like a sieve. And so to avoid that, I had to kind of get back to the middle. And when I got back to the middle, you know, I definitely hit, but didn't flip. Thank goodness. So
good. We were
fine.
Good.
You know, my dog was with me, and I think Skinner's was one of the first tests. And sometimes she would just sit under the seat in front and, in the bow and kind of rest. But then we would hit these rapids, and then the boat would sort of take on water, and the sound, you know, with the rush of the river would come on, and then suddenly she would poke her head out and be like, what are we doing?
Aww.
but she enjoyed it for the most part.
How many days did this 200-mile canoe trip take you?
So it took me 9 total. I mean, it took me 8 days to get to Titusville, and then I kind of left one day to get from Titusville to Trenton just to kind of unwind and unwrap and kind of reflect on what I was doing. That last chapter is called Falls because I was at Trenton. You get to the fall line, the Trenton Falls, where the river turns turns tidal or, you know, estuary. But I was trying to also think about that fall that I had taken 2 years prior to the trip, which was when I think I was sitting at my computer and suddenly really, you know, couldn't feel my left hand, and that was the stroke coming on.
Mm.
So 9 days to get there. I think I had to do about 25 miles a day to make it happen. The first day I only did 8 because once I got to that equinunk and the people called me over side, you know, they were almost like the sirens or something.
Okay.
Then I didn't get more than 8 miles. And then the next day I had to really kind of boogie to get down to Narrowsburg for the next day. Yeah.
And did you camp at Narrowsburg as well?
I did. So Narrowsburg, I camped, camped at Landers.
Right. Of course.
Yeah. That's one of the, that was one of the few kind of commercial campgrounds that I stayed in. And then I got to talk to Rick Lander the next day, who had had like a record year. I mean, I think that year and even the year prior, because when COVID had kind of shut things down, people couldn't go to the water parks or the amusement parks, but they could get out in the river. So
you all also stopped by Farm Arts.
Yeah, is it Willow Wisp Farm?
Willow Wisp, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Willow Wisp, yes. So it was fun, you know, obviously for me to be reading about people and places I know. And I did love the way you organized your table of contents with bridges, headwaters, confluence, eddies, rapids, islands, drift, rift, channel. Mm-hmm. I thought that...
Well, yeah, and I was supposed to kind of comment on sort of the theme of that chapter. So islands, you know, I'm sort of thinking about being by myself, and rapids, I'm thinking a little bit about risk and that kind of thing. When I did get to so I did the trip by myself in 2021, and then again in 2022 with the Lenape Nation of Pennsylvania, and we stopped at the Willow Wisp Farm, and they hosted us, and that was really kind of, that was cool. So she had invited people for a kind of potluck, and I think their neighbors had a treehouse shower. That was really awesome.
Oh, wonderful.
And that night, someone, I think they were learning that, I think one of their kids was having a baby, and someone said, name him Delaware. And then the Lenape group played a sacred song, like a song they don't always play for the occasion. So that was kind of cool. They would get together around a fire and play some drums or sing a song.
Wonderful. Sounds beautiful. The story can be called one of discovery and healing as well, correct?
Sure.
So that was another strong component of the experience.
Yeah.
How so?
Yeah, I mean, I was healing from that wound. I was also separating at the time. And then there was throw on top of that, the pandemic. So let's go out and let's do something. Let's reconnect with the river, with the birds and wildlife, with other people. And that was really a pleasant part of the trip. Let's learn how to find your way through little rapids. Really seemed like a kind of metaphor for how you're gonna kind of pick your way through various challenges, how you're gonna kind of get through, you know, grief and things like that.
Well, the river is quite a powerful metaphor.
It is. The whole idea that it kind of threaded back to my home, or, you know, where what was home was also interesting. But then I was thinking of the idea of the river being a kind of home too, and it certainly was. You know, when I got to the end, I didn't really want the trip to end. I got to my little home stretch of river, which I knew really well, and I hit like the worst headwind of the trip, and it turned the whole canoe around.
Oh boy.
And I was like, huh, this is sort of a, almost like, you know, something was telling me not, you know, that I didn't quite want to finish yet.
Uh-huh.
So I almost had to paddle backwards when I got there.
Oh, dear.
The weight of the canoe. But then I finally turned it around and we made it home.
I'm very impressed by your journey. And it was wonderful to speak with you about our beloved Delaware River. And I'm sure our listeners will love hearing about your experience and the book is Born by the River, B-O-R-N-E by the River. It's by Rick Van Noy, and the subtitle is Canoeing the Delaware from the Headwaters to Home. And I'm assuming that's available on Amazon.
Yeah, Amazon, or it's Cornell University Press, or okay. And it may be, I think I'm trying to get something going with the bookstore in Narrowsburg, One Grand. So,
oh, yes, that would be perfect. Aaron Hicklin.
Well.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Aaron Hicklin, yeah.
That would be good. Well, thank you so much for sharing your experiences of a place that has a lot of special meaning to a lot of us.
Thank you so much for talking.
You're welcome.
Valerie Manzi speaking to author Rick Van Noy. That'll do it for this edition of Radio Chatskill. Find this program and all of our local programs on our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Two Queens, making life's rituals a little more fabulous with locally roasted coffee, tea, and honey. Located in Pete's Plaza, Narrowsburg, and online at twoqueenscoffee.com.
WJFF Jeffersonville, Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.